From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, an OBGYN answers many of the common questions about COVID-19 vaccines and pregnancy. We'll learn about the legal concerns surrounding employer-mandated vaccinations. Then we look at what it takes for aging athletes to maintain an elite level of gameplay.
The really smart aging athletes are the ones that recognize how their body feels and they understand the importance of giving it time to recover from what they just have been through.
Plus, a new exhibit at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee explores artwork depicting life in a Nazi ghetto.
Maintaining humanity is such an important theme of this exhibit. This is an individual who literally needed to paint to live.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start with this. Pregnant women weren't included in vaccine trials for COVID-19. But the World Health Organization says there's no reason to believe there are specific risks that would outweigh the benefits of pregnant women getting vaccinated. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology recommends pregnant women should have access to the vaccine. But there are a lot of things they have to consider before getting vaccinated. To help answer some common questions, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with local OBGYN Dr. Sheldon Wasserman earlier this year.
When it comes to pregnant women who contract COVID-19, are they at greater risk for developing a more severe COVID-19 illness?
Yes, they are. And what happens is that they are at increased risk for hospitalizations, for ICU admissions. They're placed on the vent at higher rates. They've had issues with increasing blood pressure and premature births. It is very serious. And specifically, the ICU admission for a pregnant woman is 3 times that higher than that of a same age person who's not pregnant. So it does have serious consequences being pregnant and having COVID.
And I know we're early on, obviously, in the vaccination process, but have there been any studies on the COVID-19 vaccine on pregnant and lactating women? You know, or do we know anything preliminarily for women who have chosen to get vaccinated who are pregnant or got pregnant?
We actually do know something about it. And the data I have, as of end of January, they have 15,000 pregnant women who've been vaccinated already, and none have showed complications at all. The second part of it all is now the CDC has recruited specifically a pregnancy study of pregnant women receiving the vaccine. So not just like an incidental, are they having problems or not, like the first study of the 15,000, but now they're specifically vaccinating pregnant women and looking for complications, both for the pregnant women themselves and also issues for the baby, for the fetus. And that's an ongoing study. But so far, things are showing it to be very safe and effective.
So that's good. We've moved on from, you know, relying on self-reporting women to actively pursuing studying pregnancies.
Exactly. And the concern on pregnancy and vaccines is really a long story behind that. And in the past, it was always felt that a pregnant woman should have no vaccines. And historically, we should never touch a pregnant woman, shouldn't do anything. But the problem comes in is women do get pregnant and women do have diseases. And if we don't vaccinate them, we don't know if it's safe, if it's effective. And anecdotal reports really don't give us an idea of what we should do. So there has been a movement in medicine and the CDC and on behalf of the American College of OBGYN, which is our national organization that really is our guideline and our research organization to tell us what OBGYN should do. They're really saying and they're really pushing vaccine programs for pregnant women. And they are beginning to do this around the country for not only for COVID, but for other vaccines. And of course, we do authorize during pregnancy. There are 2 vaccines that we strongly suggest women have, and there are other vaccines we don't want. But the issue of vaccines and pregnancy is really, it's coming from a historical place of absolutely not to the current day. Yes, we have to vaccinate, and yes, we can prevent serious disease. And at the same time, let's acquire data to protect the baby too, as well as the mother.
So when it comes to the vaccine rollout for COVID-19 and the categories people are grouped under, is pregnancy considered a pre-existing condition or a medical condition considered a risk factor for COVID-19 that would put them higher up on the priority list to get vaccinated?
No, it was not. We're really looking at job occupations before we're looking at pregnancy and their specific status. It was never put in as an immunocompromised type of group of people, because the data still shows that, you know, other diseases like influenza we know is extremely serious in pregnant women, increased hospital rates and increased disease severity and severe effects on the baby. COVID doesn't show that. You still have, the overall instance is 1 in 20 pregnant women with COVID would need hospitalization. So that's still a lower number than like influenza and some other ones. So we're treating people with bigger issues, you know, being elderly, being obese, being hypertensive, having cardiac disease. Those are the real concerns. And those people, and also their occupation, you know, how much exposure they have. That's what puts people at higher rates, are up at the 1A, the 1B, 1C, but pregnancy was not put up there. It was other conditions and other things that are going on rather than just specifically pregnancy, because pregnancy right now, it has extra risk factors, but not as the severity as it is just age and the other ones that I just mentioned.
So if a pregnant woman does decide to get vaccinated, say she works in a hospital environment or things like that, that would make her eligible sooner, are there recommendations when it comes to getting vaccinated in your first, second, or third trimester?
If a woman who's pregnant and is exposed, especially in an environment where she has constant exposure to COVID-19, you know, she's at significant risk. And the American College of OBGYN has taken upon themselves with the research and the data they have. The statement is they should not have the vaccine withheld from them. That if it is offered in consultation with their physician or their healthcare provider, they should make an informed decision on what's best for themselves and their baby and their family. And that's our bottom line. So each situation is different. Now, going back to your question of first trimester, second trimester, third trimester, the current recommendation is to use a vaccine at any trimester to prevent that overall disease process. And once again, we're not seeing any problems at all. We're not seeing in the 15,000 women who've just had it and in this current ongoing study, nothing has been shown to be a problem for the babies or the mothers at this time. And once again, it's theoretical. But if a person gets sick, you know, 1 in 20 is going to get hospitalized. You know, she's pregnant and she's going to be hospitalized. That is serious. So it really comes down to that individual situation and her personal circumstance and what type of lifestyle she's living.
This might also be treading in more theoretical territory, but is there a difference of younger women who are pregnant versus those geriatric pregnancies? You know, the pregnancy in an older woman, but her overall health is still good.
I think in a situation like that, you know, once again, the age becomes a factor more than the pregnancy. And if she's older right now is more 65 and above or 60 and above, you know, and so those women obviously are not getting pregnant. But women who are in their, you know, their late 30s and their 40s, you know, who have other health concerns and they're pregnant, they're run a risk. And that discussion has to take place between their physician or other healthcare provider and that patient. But right now, if they have that exposure, if they're having that risk, a lot of them are taking the shot, taking the vaccine to protect themselves. And we're also seeing the protection also spreading to the baby. And some of the newest studies are showing that the newborns are showing antibodies to COVID who've received the vaccine. So maybe the children, maybe these babies are getting protected, although babies for the most part are very safe and, you know, they're the safest part of our society, but it can be somewhat protective for kids too.
You referenced some indications that antibodies are found in newborns, which brings me to my next question about breastfeeding. Can women who are breastfeeding get the COVID-19 vaccine? Is that a concern?
They can receive it also. So pregnancy and lactating women are really, we're putting them in the same category. It's shown to be safe and effective. Of course, if you're pregnant and you receive the shot, you're going to have higher levels than a pregnant woman who's lactating and, you know, the baby receiving less antibodies. There'll be still some transference, but very limited, and it's been still shown to be safe and effective. So the recommendation on behalf of the American College of OB-GYN is pregnant women or lactating women can receive the vaccine.
Are there concerns for people who are trying to get pregnant? You know, the big question about will it affect fertility comes to mind.
You know, this is, you know, I think we're living in an era of, you know, where politics and rumors and misinformation really have taken on a new life. And we always clearly had a real defined barrier between science and politics. And for the last few years, we've had this blurring of them, and it's very unfortunate, where rumors and misinformation and outright lies really spread. And the concern that, you know, which I've heard, can vaccines cause infertility? Are you never going to be able to have a child because you received a vaccine? There's absolutely no evidence of this. There's no absolute theoretical evidence of this. These are absolute falsehoods, and it's really very sad, and it scares people. You know, 12% of our population has infertility issues. And for the 12% of couples who have that issue, it is deep. It is personal. It's a sense of loss that the other 88% of our society really doesn't get. And I think it's absolute cruelty to tell people in this population that, oh, now maybe you got the vaccine, or you have this, you have infertility because you got the vaccine. That's just false. It's a lie, and it should never even been made up in the first place. So no, it doesn't cause fertility problems, and no, it does not cause cancer.
I suppose it's a double-edged sword to have so much information, you know, readily accessible to everyone. But ultimately, throughout our conversation, you know, what it comes down to is a conversation with you and your physician, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that one-on-one heartfelt conversation between two people, or, you know, get a second opinion. You know, you really have to have that. Your physicians, you know, the OB-GYNs in our community are keeping up to date. Our American College of OB-GYN is sending out bulletins all the time on what the latest information is on COVID and pregnancy. The State Health Department and also the CDC sends information to all physicians on, you know, the latest information. So we're really being kept updated. But as for the OB-GYN group, you know, we're getting information daily, and we translate that information into practice. So your healthcare provider should know what they're talking about. They, you know, the physicians definitely know what they're talking about. But things do change. So if you know, a week later, you still have more questions, I would suggest you call back your doctor, call back your healthcare provider. Is there something new? I'm still thinking about this. It's a new development, because we are getting developments daily in some aspects, and, you know, we can make a world of difference. So seek more information.
Dr. Sheldon Wasserman is an OBGYN in Milwaukee with the Ascension Medical Group. He's also the former chair of the Wisconsin section of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in March, and you can find more of their conversation at WUWM.com. More than half of U.S. adults have gotten at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. With a vaccine now available to anyone 16 and older, some people are returning to pre-pandemic activities, like going out to eat or working from the office instead of at home. But some people are hesitant about getting vaccinated and concerned that if they don't get it, they could face discrimination at work. Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor at UW-Milwaukee, and we spoke in January about what workers should know about the vaccine. Can you be fired if you don't get the vaccine?
Well, possibly, yes. Before anyone gets terminated for refusing a vaccine, there would have to be some consult with legal counsel to ensure that there aren't any legal hurdles that haven't been considered before terminating someone. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that guides employers when it comes to the vaccine, for example, and potential discrimination claims, which is the primary legal concern when you terminate someone or discipline someone for refusing the vaccine. They have said that it's possible to exclude such individuals from the workplace, but they emphasize in their guidance that they issued in December of last year, so just a month ago, that termination would need to be considered quite seriously, all the different types of legal concerns when you decide to terminate someone. But excluding them from the workplace is definitely possible. And what that means or looks like is going to, you know, vary by workplace, but they certainly are trying to draw a balance between keeping other employees safe at work with making sure people are getting vaccinated or at least following other alternatives versus respecting people's individual rights and potential health concerns from the vaccine.
So let's unpack that a bit. You talked a bit, I believe, about exemptions. There are some people who can't get vaccines for a variety of reasons. What are some of these exemptions?
Yes, I think the two primary ones that you'll hear most about are either a disability-related exemption, so an underlying health condition or health concern that prohibits someone from wanting to get the vaccine or being able to get the vaccine. And the second type that I think you'll hear a lot are religious-based objections to the vaccine. And both of those objections, the disability-related and the religious-based objection, have protections under our civil rights laws. And so the disability-related ones are protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act and equivalent state laws. And then the religious ones are protected under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act and equivalent state-based laws protecting religious rights.
So if your religious rights or, you know, your rights as somebody who might have a disability but has something that disallows them from getting a vaccine, you can't be fired, right?
Right. Well, you can't be fired unless there is no other way to accommodate that individual, which is going to be, I think, hard for employers not to find a way to accommodate that individual, because the EEOC has said if someone refuses to take the vaccine because of an underlying disability or health condition, your first step under the law is to work with that person to find another way that they can continue doing their job and not impact the health of others. And there are a lot of options. You know, there's social distancing, there's working remotely, there's wearing masks or other protective equipment. So, you know, there are choices out there that could be adopted and agreed to by the employer and employee to help them not have to get the vaccine, but still keep other employees safe.
You mentioned they can be exempted from the workplace, which to me sounds like while firing may be kind of the last resort, you can require that people entering your facilities get the vaccine.
Yes, you can make that a policy. Again, if there are people who have those objections that are legally protected, you know, that you have to be able to accommodate them so that they can still do their job. The law, you know, of course, recognizes that some accommodations might pose an undue hardship, significant financial requirements for the employer to meet reasonable accommodations and make the job almost impossible to do if with those types of reasonable accommodations. Those would be undue hardship. And so after going through the iterative process with the employee to find a way to help that employee still be able to do their job but not have to take the vaccine if it was required by the employer, they can't find that alternative without causing undue hardship on the employer. Then, you know, the next step might be to just exclude them from the workplace You know, there's still family leave laws that might come into effect, or other types of leave policies that might take effect at that point. But, you know, termination, I wouldn't say it's impossible, but it's there's a long road before you can get there.
You know, you mentioned that some of the exemptions are because of health reasons. There are people who can't get vaccines. I know one of the complications that is relatively common is an allergy to eggs. There are a variety of things that can cause you to have an adverse reaction to vaccines. That being said, the other exemption that you mentioned is religious. That gets into a kind of murkier area. You can prove pretty easily that you have an allergy. Do you have to prove that you are part of a religious group that doesn't believe in vaccines?
Well, the EEOC in its guidance that it issued last month said that employers would be wise to just assume that when someone raises a religious exception request, that it's a sincerely held religious belief. But as you point out, Joy, you know, religion can be very subjective, and there are religions out there that people have that are not in the mainstream, if you will, that are not familiar to everyone. And so, you know, the employer should take them at their word, but if they need additional evidence or explanation, they can ask for it from the employee. And there have been lawsuits in the past, you know, particularly in healthcare settings where mandatory flu vaccines, for example, is commonplace, where employees have raised religious objections on the flu vaccine mandate. And courts have been split as far as their willingness to side with the employee on the sincerity of their religious belief. In one case, there was an objection by an employee, and he claimed very loosely that it was tied to a religious belief. And the court in that case did not find that his belief was sincerely held. They closely examined the employee's statements about his religious beliefs and didn't find them to be credible, that it was a sincerely held, life-changing kind of religion for that case. There was another case, though, where an employee was a vegan and objected to the flu vaccine because of vegan beliefs, and there was substances in the vaccine that would have countered those vegan beliefs. And in that case, the employee prevailed, and the court sided with the employee, saying that veganism could be treated like a religious belief. So it really, when it comes to religious objections and the subjectivity of, you know, a lot of those objections, the courts, it's kind of a toss-up on what the court might do.
That's interesting, because vaccines are actually made out of the blood of horseshoe crabs. So it would seem that if you were a vegan, you might take issue with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was that one lawsuit that I mentioned. That's exactly was the facts in that case.
I don't believe they're killed in the process, I should say. They are harvested for a bit and then released back into the ocean, but it is their blood. Now, this gets to a big question that I think a lot of people who do plan to get the vaccine and return to work are really asking themselves. Can an employer reveal whether or not their employees have been vaccinated so they inform their other employees of their own personal risk?
Yeah, well, and the EEOC had released guidance when COVID testing, you know, was first coming on board, you know, less than a year ago, about whether if someone tested positive in the workplace, can employers reveal that information to employees who may have been in contact with that person? And the EEOC had guided employers that, you know, to the extent you don't have to reveal names, but just warn individuals who may have been in contact with that person that they could be at risk so they could get tested. That would be best, because what you're asking really lends itself again to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires employers to keep employee medical information confidential and separate from their regular employee records. And so revealing whether someone has received a vaccine, just as if they had tested positive, is medical information. And that information by law should be kept confidential. So employers shouldn't be revealing names. You know, that would be the guidance from the EEOC, is to reveal the information that's necessary to protect your workforce. And it's questionable whether revealing a name is necessary in a lot of circumstances.
All right. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Barbara Zabawa is a clinical assistant professor and MHA program co-director at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the author of The Tug, Finding Purpose and Joy Through Entrepreneurship. For more coverage of the pandemic and the vaccine rollout efforts here in Milwaukee, head to WUWM.com. There you'll find information about mobile vaccination sites in the city and how the state stacks up to others in vaccination rates. You can find that and much more at WUWM.com. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we'll tell you about an exhibit at Jewish Museum Milwaukee called To Paint is to Live. We'll explore how it depicts living in a Nazi ghetto during World War II. But first, the head team physician for the Bucks and the Brewers explains how Aaron Rodgers has been so successful so late in his career.
He's able to see what the defense is doing. He's able to anticipate the risk to himself and to his teammates when he distributes the ball. You combine that with, you know, he has such a quick release. Aaron Rodgers has that ability to flick the ball, you know, 40 yards down the field without effort, it seems.
That's coming up next on Lake Effect, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Aaron Rodgers is unhappy with the Green Bay Packers. He's reportedly told some within the organization that he doesn't want to return to the team this season. Rodgers is 37 years old, placing him among the oldest players in the NFL. But he continues to be competitive against players nearly half his age. So, how does he do it? Dr. Bill Rosch has some ideas. Dr. Rosch is a team physician for the Milwaukee Bucks, as well as the Brewers, and he's the head of sports medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He joined me in January to talk about ways aging sports figures can keep their careers going. What are some of the biggest concerns that really any professional sports player has as they begin to age?
Well, unfortunately, even athletes can't escape time. As we age, tissues become a little bit more brittle and recovery takes a little bit longer. And so I think athletes realize that if they don't maintain their condition to the best they can, they're more likely to be injured. And when it comes to injury, really, there's only so many things you can do to prevent injury. Luck plays a role. You can do everything correct. And especially in football, you're struck on the side of a knee by a player you never even saw, and you've got a bad knee injury. Genetics play a part. There are, without question, some individuals that, for all practical purposes, have tougher tissue. They take trauma, injury, energy to their body better than others. And so that plays a role. And then, of course, there's conditioning. Bottom line is if you're strong, you can support the joints better, fight off sort of stresses that occur during the game. And then you also want to be flexible as well. So a loose, flexible athlete can absorb energy better, is less likely to tear things. And so we look at those two things. With regards to the aging athlete, like I said, recovery, I think, is very important for them because they don't recover as quickly. Your body takes more time, and recognizing the time you need to recover is important. You know, when it comes to, for instance, baseball pitchers, you know, taking care of the Brewers, a lot of times the older pitchers are very in tune with their bodies, and they'll realize that if they had a difficult outing and threw a lot of pitches, that they may not in 2 days do their typical bullpen preparations for the next start, but rather realize, you know, I need to take a little bit more time off. My body isn't quite there. So I think the really smart aging athletes are the ones that recognize how their body feels, and they understand the importance of giving it time to recover from what they just have been through.
You mentioned some of the concerns that a pitcher might have, and a bit about, you know, just the injuries that you sustain in football. When we're looking at a quarterback like Aaron Rodgers, what are some of the unique concerns that we have with this position?
Well, football is kind of unique among the sports in that anything can happen. Let's face it. You've got large athletic individuals colliding at high rates of speed. You know, when you think about baseball, you think about shoulders and elbows, and those are pretty predictable injuries that occur often because of the unique activities they're doing. When you talk about basketball, you talk about like the box, you talk about knees, jumping, you see a lot of articular wear. Basically, they wear things out faster than most because they basically push a lifetime of activity into a relatively short career. With football, the injuries, they actually do vary by position. Quarterbacks, obviously, any type of collision, you can break an ankle, you can damage a knee, you can dislocate a hip, you can dislocate a shoulder. With quarterbacks, because they have to throw, we do worry more about shoulder injuries. Interesting enough, when you look at motion analysis, motion capture to assess the stresses on the shoulder, the football throwing motion is much less stressful on a shoulder than a baseball pitcher. Even though the football weighs more than a baseball, the velocities are different. At the same time, however, you can, with repetitive throwing, fatigue the rotator cuff, and with the cuff fatigue, then you can injure the labrum, which is this sort of bumper inside the socket that kind of holds things and gives information on how to control the shoulder. Shoulder dislocations, falling on the shoulder, the clavicle, you know, the AC joint where the collarbone meets the shoulder blade. That's a common injury that occurs when players are tackled, they land on their shoulder and they dislocate that joint. Typically, that can be a very painful injury. Fortunately, it's typically not too serious an injury and typically heals well without surgery.
Hmm. You know, of course, we're not really talking about old men. We're talking about relatively young men. Aaron Rodgers is, you know, only 37, but he's playing against much younger men. When you're in, you know, your mid to late 30s, your early 40s, how can you evolve your style of gameplay to not only keep up with these younger guys, but in some ways dominate them?
You know, I think the players that really last the longest have a level of intelligence that allows them to do that. They recognize what risk they're taking with every single play. You know, a younger player might assume they can do something they really can't get away with, and then they get hit hard, but fortunately they can tolerate that stress, that load, that impact. I think the smarter older players that stay around realize when to throw the ball away, when not to take a hit, when to fall to the ground and to protect themselves and their body. You know, but at the same time, you have extremely competitive individuals. And I think it's always a balance between that they have to sort of quench that competitive desire where they're not going to give up. They're going to do everything they can to win the game. At the same time, I think common sense does take over at some point, and they recognize when the risk is just simply too great, and they're not going to put their body into that position where they can do significant damage.
When we're looking at specifically Aaron Rodgers and his style of gameplay, is there anything that has allowed him to continue to play at this really elite level that's significantly different than what we've seen with other aging players?
Oh, I think it's his intelligence. I mean, I think he's able to see what the defense is doing. He's able to anticipate the risk to himself and to his teammates when he distributes the ball. You combine that with, you know, he has such a quick release where, you know, other players, if they're going to throw the ball, they've got to sort of wind up a little bit. Every millisecond counts, you know, getting rid of the ball before you're hit, where Aaron Rodgers has that ability to flick the ball, you know, 40 yards down the field without effort, it seems. But you have an extremely intelligent individual, and then you have an individual who has the ability to release the ball so quickly, so so he can get out of trouble relatively quickly. And he's mobile too. He still has his legs beneath him. He doesn't scramble, I think, as much as he has had before. And again, perhaps that's the intelligence taking over, I would assume. But no, I think it's the intelligence combined with his unique athletic ability to move to release the ball quickly.
I think there have been a lot of questions about Aaron Rodgers' future in general. You know, there was this player who was drafted before the season began that people were going, oh, are they looking at replacements for Aaron Rodgers? As you see him on the field, does it seem like this is a player who's winding down, or do you see a player who still has some time ahead of him?
You know, as a fan of the Green Bay Packers, I'd like to think that he has many years ahead of him. You know, like right now he's sort of the odds-on favorite, as I understand it, to be the MVP. So anytime you can be the MVP, it typically implies, I mean, just common sense dictates that, yeah, he can play a few more years. Ultimately, it's up to that player. Again, what benefits him so much is that he's just a smart guy. He understands what's going on. He sees the plays. He's able to recognize, you know, what I think he can recognize when he's putting himself in danger and when he's not, to a better degree than some other players. And so with unique ability and with a lot of smarts, typically you can significantly reduce that risk of injury. And so I take care of a lot of, you know, players at the end of their career. And the really good players recognize that they're not as good sometimes. There's certain things they can't do the same way. But that's okay because they figure out other ways of doing it. If you have, for instance, a pitcher that used to throw fastballs in the high 90s, but now he tops out at, let's say, 92 instead of 98, well, he can't strike out guys as easily as before without that extremely fast pitch. But what does he do? He learns how to vary the speed. He learns how to add additional pitches to keep the batter off balance. So that all of a sudden that 92 mile per hour fastball seems like it's 98 because he just threw him something in the 70s, the pitch before. So again, as you lose, and then we all do, there's no question about it. As we age, we lose speed, we lose strength. That's just the natural aging process. We take longer to recover. Our tissues become more brittle. But if you can use your intelligence and learn how to, and recognize, I think you also have to recognize those limitations, that creates the successful individual that can continue to play, you know, as long as they really have that competitive desire to do so.
Well, hopefully he doesn't pack up and take those smarts to jeopardy long term. But
yeah.
Dr. Rosh, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. You take care.
Dr. Bill Rosh is the head of sports medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also a lead team physician for the Milwaukee Bucks, Milwaukee Brewers, and Milwaukee Ballet. We spoke in January. Coming up, we'll tell you about an exhibit at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee called To Paint is to Live.
Being forced to relive those experiences and the detail that he includes in these works just goes to show that it is seared into his memory. And I'm sure was until the day he died.
That's coming up next, right here on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Jewish Museum Milwaukee has reopened with temperature checks, limited capacity, and an exhibit. To Paint is to Live tells the story of Czech Jewish artist Erich Lichtblau Leskly, who documented life in the Theresienstadt ghetto during World War II. Through cartoonish drawings and commentary, Lichtblau Leskly recorded life in the ghetto for posterity and for his own sanity. After a crackdown on creativity in the ghetto, Lichtblau Leskly, with the help of his wife, meticulously tore up and hid his artwork beneath the floorboards. Both the artist and the artwork survived the war, and the original drawings are pieced back together alongside newer versions at the Jewish Museum Milwaukee. Molly Dubin is the curator of the museum, and she sat down to talk with Ben Binversian March about the exhibit and the reopening of the museum.
Can you tell us a little bit about why you chose to reopen the museum with this exhibit?
In the spring, we tend to do some type of Holocaust exhibit, as that is the time when middle and high schools hit World War II and Holocaust studies in terms of curriculum. But it also has some incredibly interesting parallels in terms of what we've been experiencing as a society over this past year, both with the pandemic and issues of social and political unrest.
Yeah, I was thinking about this exhibit and how it does offer a very striking parallel to our current situation, kind of coming out of a pandemic, and we're certainly not out yet, but signs of life are starting to emerge as people get vaccinated, and we're starting to put the pieces of our lives back together. What do you think this exhibit has to say about how to keep our humanity during difficult times?
You just used the word kind of putting our pieces of our lives back together, which is really apt because this exhibit really has two major components. One is a series of work that was created while Eric Leskly was imprisoned at Theresienstadt ghetto. And thankfully, he and his wife survived, and they were able to retrieve and put those fragments back together. And then the paired group is a recreation that Eric embarked on in the early 70s while the family was living in Israel. And so it physically has that connection of putting pieces back together, but also maintaining humanity is such an important theme of this exhibit. This is an individual who literally needed to paint to live. That's where the title comes from. It was that, you know, central to his existence. And a big part of this was maintaining humanity, you know, maintaining a foothold in the creative aspect of your life and your existence that allows you to, you know, to continue. It's an impetus to continue. There's also a catharsis to it. The idea of being able to digest and then, you know, put onto paper the experiences, the documentation of daily life behind the ghetto walls.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the man behind the drawings and how he ended up documenting life in the Theresienstadt ghetto and surviving?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, he had a background in actually having apprenticed as a teen to a window designer, you know, that would entice people to buy products or clothing. He did in the 30s have an opportunity to go to school for commercial design. But all that being said, he really never considered himself an artist, but he did an incredible job of documenting everyday life, and in such a way that it really is quite jarring. When you look at the pieces, they look like cartoons. There's a very, you know, caricaturesque quality to them. And I think part of that is because of his background in, you know, commercial design. But also when you think about trying to cope with the absolute surreal circumstances under which he and his wife and all those imprisoned at Theresienstadt were a part of, it's almost fitting. It's this, you know, this incredibly atrocious narrative juxtaposed with this very inviting, you know, vividly colored palette of pieces that really engages you because it is so cartoon and, you know, appears just, when first encountering, to be fairly benign, but then you get into it and you realize what he is depicting. And that pairing is incredibly powerful. It also really speaks to, when we talk about, you know, parallels to what's been going on, it's both a social cartoon and a political cartoon. It's, you know, they're social in that they document the, you know, injustices that were going on, but they also reveal the truth behind the Nazi deception, particularly at Theresienstadt, which was known as a model camp. One of the main reasons being is that Hitler embarked on a beautification campaign in anticipation of a visit by the International Red Cross. And that wound up culminating in this incredible hoax that convinced this delegation that this wasn't such a bad place. So, you know, again, this idea of the surreal versus the reality, the importance of documenting truth and being able to get that message out to the world with something that is undeniable in the form of a documented visual account. And you think back to all the things that have happened over the year and have gone viral and have gotten the message out on a huge scale, and the impact that that has had.
As a documentarian, what he did was extremely valuable. Did you know at the time, was he making them for a particular purpose?
Very much it was a coping mechanism. I think for a number of individuals who were imprisoned, the creative process of documentation was multi-leveled. Unfortunately, in 1944, there were a number of well-known artists who were also imprisoned there, who were creating work clandestinely. They were found out about. The Nazis tortured them horribly, and they were sent to their deaths. Of course, Eric and Elsa got word, and Elsa, previous to this, had been hiding the creations under her barrack where she slept, and Eric wanted to destroy them completely because he knew what their fate would be if they were found out. She would not hear of it. She understood the importance. And so what they wound up doing was, you know, cutting or tearing them into fragments, absolutely removing any text or wording that could identify, you know, they're trying to communicate what was going on. And they were hidden in a dark, damp place in the ghetto. And thankfully, they survived. And when the Red Army, when the Soviets liberated Theresienstadt in 1945, they were able to retrieve those pieces and put the fragments back together.
You know, I wonder what Eric felt when he found the art and how that relationship evolved later in life as he revisited these pieces.
I mean, he continued to create, you know, from the time they were in prison through liberation, that it was something that he was driven to do. But in the early 70s, when he really embarked on this project of recreating each piece and going into greater detail, and you think about the fact that he is now, all these years later, really being forced to relive those experiences and the detail that he includes in these works just goes to show that it is seared into his memory, and I'm sure was until the day he died.
How does this exhibit fit with the mission of the museum right now?
Well, I want to, you know, just answer that in a couple ways. When you talk about inviting people back in, I'm excited that this is the exhibit that we're physically reopening with, because there is something that you just can't get when you are, you know, if you're in physical proximity to an artifact or a piece of art like this, particularly the, you know, the fragmented piece, there's something that just happens that is a physical, you know, tangible feeling of understanding the history of this piece and making that physical connection. You can appreciate it online, but being face to face with it is something else entirely. So we are so excited to be able to welcome people back to experience this exhibit and to experience it safely. We've taken, you know, many, many precautions so that people who purchase their tickets online, which we encourage them to do so they can reserve a spot. And, you know, we're making sure to manage those numbers for social distance purposes. We highly encourage you to do that. And it's very special. It's truly an honor to be reopening with this exhibit, this message, and these type of parallels to everything we have collectively been going through in terms of humanity and And for many of us, I think thinking about our place in it, we've all had those moments over this past year of, you know, that thinking on a much bigger scale. And this is such a fitting exhibit to be able to kind of take those steps back in to re-entering those connections with other people.
Molly Dubin is the curator of Jewish Museum Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Ben Binversi in March about the exhibit called To Paint is to Live, the artwork of Eric Lichtblau Leskley. You can see the exhibit in person by visiting the museum's website and registering for a visit online. Or you can participate in the virtual programming on their website. You can find pictures of Lichtblau Leskley's artwork and more information about the exhibit at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's Lake Effect. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, you can find all of our content as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to hear some of our favorite interviews, look for Lake Effect Spotlight. Tomorrow on Lake Effect Bubbler Talk, we'll find out why there's a statue of Gandhi at the Milwaukee County Courthouse. Plus, with spring's arrival, you may have noticed a bit more wildlife around the city. We'll talk about some of the wild animals you can see inside the city limits. That's all tomorrow at 10, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.